digest a lot of the information, and perhaps reassuring that for this final talk that I hope that many of the points were hit. I'm Dr. David Houghton. I'm a neurologist by training and by trade. I still am clinical about 50% of my time. I work in the Parkinson's and movement disorder arena, so take care of a lot of aging patients and those that have grown to benefit a lot from different technologies and ways that we can reach them in different ways, both physically but also emotionally on their healthcare journey. I work for Ochsner Health down in New Orleans. It's a large healthcare system. We have 48 different hospitals, more than 300 urgent cares and clinics. We see about a million patients per year as we extend across Louisiana, Mississippi, and then a little bit into the Gulf parts of Alabama and Florida now. And for this group, again, it's many of the points will be hammered home tonight, sort of similar to what you've all heard today. But I think it is important to recognize that the epidemic of chronic disease was never more evident during COVID, where we recognize facts such as 40% of patients delayed getting some of the medical treatments that they needed prior to being exposed to telemedicine and digital health. Diabetes leads in this country as the number one cause of the epidemic of chronic disease. And we recognized quite early on that it was the presence of these comorbidities that made a global pandemic so risky for folks and will likely still impact whichever the next one may be. Another way that this was measured was with this survey asking respondents where they felt that they were the greatest impacts were. Reduction in care of diabetes, strongly number one in those co-occurring diseases. This is really on the right side, the diabetes plus story, diabetes plus hypertension, plus COPD, plus heart disease, plus depression. These are the ones that are recognizing they're being left behind in the current ways that we take care of our patients. Similarly, two large health systems looked at the data on their ability to measure these problems. So you can see the plummeting of tests, screening tests for blood sugar, screening tests for high cholesterol in April of 2020. On the right side, you can similarly see as a surrogate of those patients being able to access their needs, the lack of new prescriptions being written for diabetic and cholesterol therapy. And so with that as a bit of a backdrop, then this was from an interesting article. 2020 was declared the dawn of digital medicine, right? I mean, there was no digital medicine happening before that. Well, and if you think about it, there's some rather unique things that were discovered. So who knows when the fax machine was invented? It was well before the telephone. Most pharmacies and hospitals, I can tell you the ones that I work with, we still fax and post patient records. We heard about the plight with Italy, Spain, during their early phases of the pandemic, realized that there was zero way for many of their hospitals to be able to communicate with each other. And yet, this is from a talk I gave almost 5 years ago. So the dawn of digital medicine, 2020, well, there's a hell of a lot of money being put into that dawn well before the sun rose. Then in 2018 and 2019, talking about companies like Livongo and what Amazon was doing at that time, where Hims had grown, we realized that the dollars that were being put in over this industry has really been enormous over the last 5 years. So I struggle to feel that 2020 was the dawn of digital medicine. But of course, there was more digital disruptors coming in 2020 and 2021. But look at how the headlines changed a bit here. This is really where it pivoted from just startup dollars to the influence of pharmacies and the influence of the payers. So Cigna and Amada getting together, Livongo expanding with CVS Health, Florida Blue right here working with Teladoc and Livongo. So there was a little bit of a change in the tone, a little bit of a change in the direction of where the consolidation was going and where the dollars were going. But we saw in the last talk about hype. Who's heard of the hype cycle? Sometimes called the Gartner hype cycle, where you have some sort of trigger which then follows a peak of inflated expectations that's followed by the trough of disillusionment, after which there's some recognition of the value in that slope of enlightenment, and finally the plateau of productivity. And I think we're all at risk as healthcare providers of sort of trying to encourage 3,500 physicians who work in our organization to say, don't worry, we've got something better coming. The next thing is really going to work out. And so it's not surprising that, in fact, if you see this chart here, this follows pretty closely the hype cycle, right? This is the utilization of telehealth, less than 1% of all visits prior to the pandemic, then peaks in our organization in the 50 to 60% range, and then it drops, not truly with the trough of disillusionment. And you could argue that, well, now we're still at, you know, 20x what we were doing before, so we probably have reached some plateau of productivity. But how do we maintain it? Is there a risk for a second fall, a second trough of disillusionment? I think we've heard from a lot of people today that there still is that risk. There's risk when you don't have alignment in organizations, where you don't have the ability for interoperability between EMRs, risk of our payer models changing significantly. And so, you know, this hasn't been lost on that same industry that's been doling out the checks for the last 5 years. This was an article from Fast Company just at the beginning of this year talking about how telehealth took off, but 2021 was a brutal awakening. Well, again, 20x still from what it was before, but as soon as this happened, everyone forgot about the hype cycle and presumed that we were going to be left with 60% of all care being digital first or second. And of course, then the money follows, right? And so as we've met other similar recessional times in the broader economy, that digital health funding has had a similar sort of cycle. And so really, if we get down to it, we need to remember, what are the disruptors trying to disrupt again? We're disruptors, what are we trying to fix? And much of this is these enormous gaps in care in rural environments or relative healthcare deserts in urban environments, the inability for certain physicians to be able to communicate with other practitioners and other folks as parts of allied health teams. And all of that results in gaps in care related to chronic diseases. Again, the last talk similarly showed some of these types of statistics and how it relates to the overall cost of care. You know, $4.5 trillion, 86% of it goes to the treatment of chronic disease in this country. And we need help, because less than only 10% of all of the impactful subcategories on somebody's health and wellness is actually managed effectively in the traditional healthcare setting. So we know that 40% can be attributed to behavioral patterns, social circumstances, another 15%, genetic predisposition, and the work we heard today talking about genomics, and our healthcare institution is working diligently with precision medicine with genomics as the backbone. All of these things. We even have an environmental program in New Orleans and the surrounding area where we measure our air quality levels in a digital program that informs our COPD members that it's a lousy day for air in the Gulf South. You might want to stay inside. So if you could recognize other ways other than the traditional health care and use the social determinants of health that we've all become so attuned to now, well, then we're ready for this. But the problem is, it's built on the back of primary care physicians. And we have a unique shortage of primary care physicians. We knew there was going to be a shortage a decade ago. And then you compound that now by the burnout rates, which are rising, by the recent changes that we've gone through, and then the utilization of APPs, advanced practice providers like PAs, nurse practitioners. There's a similar exodus out of the healthcare industry. Nobody can keep up because they're stuck on the hamster wheel. So if we really take a step back, there is some tools that we have in our tool chest that may be effective. And again, I was reminded by the last panel, sort of thinking about tried and true measures of how we are able to assess what's going on with a certain situation. And so these are the five A's that I learned back after college, before medical school. I was fortunate to get a master's in public health and epidemiology and biostatistics from Emory in Atlanta, and I worked with a neonatologist turned researcher named Dr. Brian McCarthy. And so Brian and I worked for several years before he convinced me, thankfully, to go to medical school, looking at maternal and infant mortality in the state of Georgia, across the Southeast, and internationally. And he taught me a lot about his five A's. Now, I thought they were all his five A's for a long period of time until I did some reading back in the 70s and 80s, and many of these had been pitched before. But I have brought this technique to the digital and telehealth programs that we build at Ochsner, and I tell them, as we had talked about, or as the panel talked about, you start with asking the questions, and you find it out from the patients, and you find it out from the docs. Is this really appropriate? If you don't start with this first A, you're never going to get to the last day of acceptability. So should we try something new? What's the quality of it? Can we trust it? And then the availability, accessibility, and affordability is really the when, the how, and the how much. And so if you don't add in the when, the how, and the how much, that's not going to be able to accelerate. And then lastly, will somebody actually do this? So, you know, we all talk about our iPhones. Who remembers the Apple Newton? Anybody remember the Apple Newton? It's important that you should remember the Apple Newton because it was why we have the iPhone now. But Steve Jobs had a lousy job with the 5As. It was this sort of computer-ish phone that was about the size of this right here. And it cost about $1,000 20 years ago, and it had some voice recognition that didn't work, and it had some, it was even in the pre-Palm Pilot days, right? So you weren't even able to quite recognize handwritten techniques. And so ultimately it wasn't acceptable. But if you go back to a lot of the tenets that Paul talked about and on the last panel, it really, if you get down to how you assess something and create something from scratch, if you fall back on these 5As like we used to do in clean water projects when I was getting my master's in public health and looking at infant mortality, it actually pays off. And so the other thing that we've talked about today, which again is very, I think, enlightening to hear this group think about it, is that patient centricity. And boy, this is a really difficult glossary of terms to keep straight. I started looking at this with some work that I was doing in my bricks and mortar life as a neurologist a few years ago, and I read about patient education, and then they said, well, it's not really patient education, it's patient activation. There's a patient activation measure score that you can do. But then they said, well, it's not really activation, it's engagement, and it, maybe it's the experience. You know, the experience is all of these things, plus those things that you can't control. So when I get ranked by my patients, sometimes they'll put in the comments, the parking lot was really full today. Yeah. Or I had lunch and, you know, the cafeteria is too expensive, but that's still part of the patient experience. And there are patient experience teams falling in one of those other silos in a hospital that look at those things that aren't directly related to health. But this is really important as it relates to digital health. You can say, well, I got rid of the expensive food and the lousy parking because you're at home. But then what is the patient experience? Well, it's whether or not the device works. It's whether or not it syncs appropriately. And then lastly, patient satisfaction, which I think is one of the more interesting things, is that people talk about your patient satisfaction, but that's just measuring something. So that's just figuring out some aspect, either narrow or broad, of what the healthcare service is. And so as you know, I was sort of playing definition, I put this together. I'm not that clever with PowerPoint, but sort of figured out that, well, education rises, you know, if this is bronze, then activation is silver and engagement's gold. The experience is probably platinum, and whether you're going to measure any of it is really where satisfaction comes into play. And there are tools to measure all of these things because they will give you different information as you look at those different layers. And as it's been indicated, but this is, again, as a Parkinson's doc, you know, I read the literature probably not as closely as Paul does, but I also read AARP and you. I don't know if this one sits in our waiting room. And this was actually a great one that I picked up, sort of showed the advantages of that patient-provider dyad. And you want an activated patient. They use the patient activation measure to do this. You could argue that means they were engaged and they were overeducated somewhere from the last slide. But look, you're twice as likely to get readmitted to the hospital within 30 days as a patient if you're not activated, if you're not having that connection with your care team. You're almost twice as likely to experience medical error, almost 35% of the time. Talked about that risk of medical errors in the hospital. Three times as likely to have poor care coordination. 3.5 times as likely to suffer a poor consequence. That's almost 50% of the time. And then maybe for the CFOs in the room, you're going to lose confidence in the healthcare system almost 60% of the time if you're just considered to be a less activated patient than a more activated patient. And we heard about this earlier today, sometime around lunchtime, how we were talking about patients as consumers. Sometimes I don't like the sterility of the term of consumer. I figure, gosh, all those days I toiled in medical school and residency and fellowship, I don't want to think of my patients as consumers, but I really should. And here's one of the best reasons for it. This is some great work done by Dr. Boissy at the Mayo Cleveland Clinic, pardon me. If you are a consumer, right, if I'm going to punch Uber in a half hour to get to the airport, I'm expecting easy access to the services, easy communication. I want the service to be expected. I want to know the costs. I want to see my records. And I feel like I'm in control, except for the guy driving. I'm in control. My fear and vulnerability, other than just traffic and making it on time, is pretty low. As a patient, that flip-flops. Fear and vulnerability is high. The perception of control is low. And that's because the access is dictated by a healthcare system traditionally or by limited channels of communication. And the services, you know, we appreciate it. Thanks, doc. But in fact, if we are able to convert a patient experience into a consumer experience, that really can unlock a lot of the advantages. And importantly, I think, and this was highlighted in another talk also, keeping those patients at the front. We talked about co-production was the term. I think this is a terrific, this is from New England Journal a couple years ago. I think it's a great way to look at it. Patients number one. Now, reassuringly, as the provider, nurses and care teams more so than physicians, tech vendor seventh, right? So again, with all due respect for all the tech that we are so reliant on, all the programs that we run, and all the vendors that we have terrific relationships with, don't let the tail wag the dog. Let's make sure that we've got the patient centricity and the provider centricity. That dyad partnership is going to be the ones that have demonstrated in our organization and in yours will help as well. And one of those things that we looked at so heavily, and my colleague Dr. Rich Milani, who works in digital health with Amy Quirk and Jonathan Wilt and others, was just looking at chronic disease management a few years ago. We did this back in 2015 for the first time, and we just asked these questions. You know, if you're going to see your doctor, and you're only going to see him a couple times a year, you only know what someone's blood pressure is a couple times a year. And we all make the same excuse, right? You say, you had to truck all the way from the parking lot, and that's why it's 140 over 90, and it's probably 120 over 80 like you tell me it is. Or we're only going to see him episodically, and docs have trouble following the guidelines. I'm in our digital hypertension program. I'll be 50 years old this year. My blood pressure has been under great control since it was recognized when I was in medical school, and I was on Atenolol for 20 years, which has slowly gotten further and further down the recommended drug of choice to manage blood pressure. And so when I joined digital hypertension, they said, you're great, except for that's not the right drug for you. We're going to switch it. And, you know, with all due respect to my primary care doc that I know and love, it was the same thing of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But sometimes we can fix it, and that's going to mean I'm going to be healthier in 20 years, 30 years, hopefully much more than that. And so we just ask these questions. Where can we share data? How can we keep updated? Where can we track prescriptions? And I heard a great shout-out to the clinical pharmacists earlier as other members of the Allied Health team. And in Louisiana, we've been able to harness the power of something called a CDTM, the Collaborative Drug Therapy Monitoring Agreement, where a physician is able to partner with a clinical pharmacist. And so we enroll patients. We give them all these devices to go home with. They get a clinician team that's not a physician clinician. This is either a clinical pharmacist, and when we go across state lines, we use physician assistants if they don't recognize the value of doctorate-level pharmacists in those states. Shame on them. And you add a health coach in, and it's a little different than what some of the other remote patient monitoring programs are doing. Some of you may have heard my question about, you know, the reimbursement. We built this for now 30,000 patients, not worrying about reimbursement because we're recognizing the value on the back end. But as we're partnering with health systems, partnering with payers, partnering with other brokers, we do per member per month. We don't want somebody to have to figure out that they've got to send 16 blood pressure readings in because 14 blood pressure readings won't get paid for by CMS. And so we go with a per member per month model to try to make sure that this works. Like I said, we're not alone in the idea. These are all of the industry competitors in some degree who have similarly started these programs. They're various levels of management versus monitoring, I would suggest. But much of the reporting, much of the logic that people have lifted these programs off the ground have been on clinical and have been on quality results. But I think, you know, for us, moving to these connected care models really is this formula. It's not just the clinical quality, which these are examples of how we generate clinical quality, but it's also the value. It's showing reduction of utilization in ERs and shorter hospital stays and fewer visits to the urgent care, all the while maintaining primary care visits. It's actually interesting that we don't see reduction in primary care visits. In fact, for some people, the primary care visits go up because now they've got new relationships and they feel trusted as that's been connected. We talked about satisfaction. I love the Net Promoter Score. Maybe that makes me feel like a little bit of a tech nerd for a minute, because it's a simple question, single question, but we'll measure that satisfaction in 1,000 different ways, combining clinical quality, value, and satisfaction. Really tells us why we do it. And so we talked about the 5 A's. My new 6th A, and I told this to my old friend Brian McCarthy, who's retired now a couple years ago, is accelerate. And he was willing to change. He was willing to accept a 6th A. And the way to accelerate, I think, is to consider all of these ways that you're connecting with the patients and solutioning the providers on a continuum. And so this was something that just came out with the advisory board. I know we saw something from the advisory board in the last talk. Sort of talks about that walk from active in-person care all the way to sort of passive remote monitoring. And we felt reassured when this came out because this is very similar to a slide that we had developed that sort of showed this similar pathway for us. So we're an Epic shop. And so we've been able to harness the power of our relationship for our virtual visits. We're doing e-visits through MyChart. We're doing e-consults. We're part of the AAMC, American Academy of Medical Colleges, core program for e-consults and showing how that drives value. We use Epic Care Companions and flow charts inside of MyChart with MyChart Care Companion, and then our digital medicine program, like I mentioned. And so lastly, I'll just close. I think, you know, as we've accelerated now out of the pandemic, and we're trying to figure out how to avoid the hype cycle, and it's not going to be 70%, but it's probably not going to be 7%. And how do we sit, you know, somewhere above with our utilization and connectivity? It's really these 5 things. And from my perspective, it's got to be convenient. The patients insist upon it. Doctors insist upon it. It's got to be engaging. It's got to be proactive and allowing for that data transfer that's easy. I think that personalized touch, and in this case, you know, so many of ours is, it doesn't stop with coaching. We don't say, oh, it's a coaching app. We're going to add that on. I think you need to put it together. And so for us to actively manage and prescribe medicines and create connections from specialist to specialist for things like e-consults is really critical. And lastly, it's got to be integrated. We talked a lot about the lack of integration and gaps in the ability of different health organizations to be able to communicate with each other. For us, like I said, 1 million patient visits, 48 hospitals, but that still doesn't mean we're the only game in town, even in New Orleans. And so for us to be able to communicate across those platforms is really critical. So with that, at the end of the day, I will give it back to our esteemed host, who I think has put together a fabulous day of rapid-fire talks and really has hit a lot of the high points. So thanks to all of you.